Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for June 15th, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, probing the neurobiology of charitable giving, how the invention of cooking may have spurred human brain evolution, and the challenges in developing a sustainable bioeconomy. All this, plus our usual roundup of other stories from science and its online daily news site, Science Now. So stick around. Why do people give to charities? A behavior that seems directly contrary to their economic self-interest. It's a deceptively simple question, and one that has puzzled neuroscientists and economists for decades. A study by an interdisciplinary team from the University of Oregon, published in this week's Science, has cast some new light on that old question. We're delighted to have one of the authors of the study, Ulrich Meyer, on the line with us now to bring us into better touch with our altruistic sides. Dr. Meyer, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, in your paper, you note that there are basically two ways that economists have looked at the motives behind charitable giving. Could you just explain those to us briefly?
Yes, Stuart. As you said, philanthropy seems to go against self-interest, and one way to explain it without giving up the self-interest axiom is to say that it's the process of giving away money to some good cause itself that makes people feel good. So, for example, because it's a way of promoting oneself as a good person, both to oneself and others, and people get what economists call a warm glow out of the giving. And obviously, this is a somewhat cynical view where philanthropy is only egoism in disguise and where the well-being of others is merely an indirect means towards a self-serving goal. On the other hand, people might actually genuinely care about the well-being of others as an end in itself. And this is what economists would refer to as pure altruism. Thus here, it's not critical how exactly the well-being of others is promoted, not even whether oneself has any involvement in that improvement. All that should count is the improvement itself.
So we have these two models, one of which is pure altruism and one of which is warm glow, as it's called. And which of them is correct, I guess, has some interesting kind of real-world implications in terms, for example, of government policy and how charitable causes are actually funded.
Yeah, this is correct. Assume you were, for example, motivated to see improvement in, let's say, the healthcare and housing conditions of the poor in your area. And then you observe that your state government significantly increases the amount of financial aid available for these causes. If your main concern now were purely altruistic in how well the poor are doing, you will probably at this point refrain from giving additional money for this cause and rather keep it for yourself. On the other hand, if your main concern is making a good impression, then you may be less affected by how much the government is doing. And the fact that charitable giving should be reduced to the same degree as government funding takes over is what economists call crowding out. And in fact, the analysis of such crowding out patterns has been the main way in which they have tried to infer the relative contributions of pure altruism versus warm glow. Of course, these are sort of fairly indirect and basically macro and economic tools to get what is happening inside people's brains, and therefore it would be really nice to be able to track these motives in a more direct manner within individuals.
And that presumably is what you're trying to do in this study. So how do we actually, in the kind of study you're talking about, how do we actually tease out which of these motives is really at work?
Yeah. So, I mean, for obvious reason, you can't simply ask people, do you give money because you want to make a good impression or because you really care? So we need to find a different way to get at people's deepest motives. And one way to do this is to look at brain areas that determine what motivates us and what not. And so these are evolutionary, ancient areas in the middle of the brain. Most prominent one is called the nucleus accumbens, and they respond to basic pleasures such as food, social comfort, sweets. More recently, it has also been shown that they actually respond to financial gains. So our reasoning was the following. If these pleasure areas respond to improvements in the well-being of others. Even if one is not responsible for that improvement, then this would provide a direct measure of pure altruism. On the other hand, if these areas respond only when oneself can feel responsible for these improvements, then this would indicate that it's not about the others, but ultimately about yourself, and this would be an expression of the warm glow motive.
Okay, well, that sounds well-constrained. How did you actually set up an experiment to study it?
Well, each of our participants was given initially $100, and then they crawled into the MRI scanner that allows us to track the brain activity. And in the scanner, then, they saw a series of scenarios in each of which a certain amount of money was taken out of their own pocket, and a certain amount of money was given to the charity's account. And as a charity, by the way, we used the local food bank called Food for Lane County. And half of these transfers, then, participants simply had to observe passively. So this is very much like paying taxes. You do not bear any responsibility for the transfer of funds out of your own pocket to some other cause. And for the other half of the scenarios, participants could decide by pressing a button whether or not they wanted to accept a particular donation or wanted to make a particular donation or not. So this is the situation that could potentially elicit warm glow, because it was actually people's decisions whether or not they wanted to give.
And what came out of this? What did you find?
Well, we found three things. First, we did find that money going to the charity from your own account actually elicits neural activity in those very pleasure and reward areas that we talked about, and that this happens even in the tax-like situation when you cannot claim any responsibility. And this is pretty strong evidence for pure altruism. Then we can take those, that's the second result, we can take those responses both to the charity and to oneself, and we can compare those, and we find we can group people into those whose brain responses are stronger for money going to the charity than money to themselves, and we call these people the altruists, and those people who have stronger response to money going to themselves than to the charity, we call the egoists, and we find that the altruists actually do give twice as much money as the egoists, neurally defined. And the third response is that we actually do find an additional small increase in the neural pleasure response when these donations can be made in a voluntary manner. And this then in the end is consistent with warm glow. So in other words, each act of giving seems to be derived from probably a mixture of these two motives. We are not completely egoistic, but most of us aren't 100% altruistic either. But we can look at the brains and determine thereby the contribution of each of these two motives.
Well, Dr. Meyer, thanks for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
Ulrich Meyer of the University of Oregon is the co-author, with William Harbaugh and Daniel Burkhardt, of a new study on the motives behind charitable giving. The paper appears in the June 15th issue of Science. Coming up in a moment, how learning to cook our food may have helped make us human.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
Enjoying a well-cooked meal is one of the incomparable pleasures of being human. But some scientists are wondering if the invention of cooking may have been one of the things that actually helped humans, and the human brain in particular, make the great evolutionary leap forward over the past 2 million years. Joining me now to talk about this new work is science contributing correspondent Anne Gibbons, who writes about the topic in a News Focus article this week. Anne, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Anne, just what has happened to the human brain over the past 2 million years?
Well, put simply, our brains have tripled in size in the past 2 million years. For many years, for millions of years, our human ancestors walked upright and acted human in many ways, but their brains were the size of chimpanzees. And then this new human ancestor, Homo erectus, arrived on the scene about 1.9, 1.8 million years ago in Africa and then later in Asia. And this ancestor's brain doubled in size. That happened around 1.6 million years ago. That's when it may have happened earlier, but that's when a skull shows it as being twice the size of a chimpanzee's brain. And there is some evidence that a skull that's a little earlier than that also would have been larger, too. And then with our species, Homo sapiens, when it arose about 200,000 years ago, our brains had tripled in size by then, and also in Neanderthals, who even have bigger brains than our species, which is interesting.
And all this brain expansion happened why?
Well, the traditional view is that we started eating meat. We start seeing the first stone tools in the fossil record around 2.7 million years ago, which is before the brain begins to expand, but we also then begin to see evidence for butchering meat and carrying it to central, possibly home bases. So it looks like our ancestors were processing more meat by 2 million years ago. So the traditional view has been eating more meat gave us more energy more efficiently, and we got bigger brains because of that.
Okay, well, that seems like a nice kind of well-posed story. What could be the problem with that?
Well, here's the problem. When you look at modern humans and you look at other animals the same size as us, we eat the same number of calories as they do. But our brains are voracious. A resting baby's brain, a baby that isn't even doing anything, just napping, consumes 60% of all the energy it takes in. And an adult's brain, our brains, consume 25% of our resting energy when we're just sitting around watching TV or something, as compared to 8%. An ape's brain takes in about 8% of its energy. So the riddle was, where did we get the extra energy if we're taking in the same number of calories? And this is where several different hypotheses come in, including the notion that cooking food might give us more energy.
And how would cooking food actually accomplish that? I'm not sure I get it.
Well, when you heat food, you break down the molecules, and it's much easier to absorb the nutrients in them. You break down the food. It's sort of a pre-digestion that happens. So what happens is it takes a lot less energy for us to digest the nutrients in food that's been cooked. And Richard Wrangham came up with this idea. He's a primatologist at Harvard who'd studied chimpanzees in Africa. And he'd noticed that when a chimp got a little more food, it often had a huge advantage reproductively. Its offspring did better. So he was thinking about what would have given Homo erectus an advantage. And he was sitting around the fire one night in Boston, lying there thinking about cooking would have made a huge difference. We should see an immediate impact on our ancestors' bodies when they start cooking. And so he has now done studies to show that, interestingly, there were very few studies showing what cooking does to food. His colleagues actually fed pythons and mice, cooked up ground beef, and then they cooked they gave the same number of calories of raw meat to pythons and mice as well, and found that the animals that had the cooked ground beef used a lot less energy and grew a lot bigger in a short amount of time.
Well, that's a nice kind of line of empirical evidence, but I guess the $64 question is whether there's any actual evidence that our ancestors were cooking their food at around the time this brain size expansion was seen. Is there any such evidence?
Well, this is the problem for Wrangham's hypothesis, his cooking hypothesis, and that is that really strong evidence for cooking doesn't show up in the archaeological record for the past 400,000 to 300,000 years with the arrival of our species, Homo sapiens. That's when you see these wonderful patterns of stones and evidence of hearths and maybe even of pots that were used for cooking. Very clearly, we are cooking animals at that point. We're very accomplished at it. There is evidence for controlled fire, possibly a hearth, in Israel at 800,000 years ago. And then there are claims for controlled fire as early as 1.5 million. But archaeologists who really want to have a strong test for cooking say just the evidence of controlled fire and even a fire at 1.5 million may not be enough. These could be fires, forest fires or fires from lightning that got out of control. So that is the problem, is showing that there really is strong evidence for cooking, not just that there's fire at 1.5 million.
Okay, well, some problems in the details with the cooking hypothesis. Is there anything else that might explain this?
Well, one idea that's a decade old is that at the same time our brains began to get larger, our guts got smaller. We had a higher quality diet. This is called the expensive tissue hypothesis. And Leslie Aiello came up with this notion that our guts got smaller because we didn't need as big guts. We were eating a better diet with more meat, possibly cooked meat. This might be part of the picture as well. And so we didn't need to have as large guts to digest that food. And that freed up a lot of energy from that organ to help feed the voracious brain.
So essentially there was, you know, we were taking in the same amount of calories perhaps, but more of it was able to go to the brain because these other tissues weren't being developed.
That's exactly right. And again, animal studies have shown that there are trade-offs like this in other animals. In primates, it's often the gut. In birds, it may be that their pectoral muscles, their pecs get smaller if they need to have a bigger brain. So that's exciting. Evidence is backing that view up. And then meanwhile, a third thing happens, which is there's a slowdown in our life histories. That means we have longer childhoods. It takes us longer to grow up, which means there is more time to grow a larger brain and to make it more complex. And evidence is accumulating for both of those lines of evidence. And people think it's an exciting time because it looks like these things are all beginning to come together. There were probably this remarkable convergence of several things going on that gave us this lovely side effect, a big brain.
Well, Anne, thanks for giving us a taste of this story today.
You're welcome.
The News Focus article, Food for Thought, by Science contributing correspondent Anne Gibbons, appears in the June 15th issue of Science. Just around the corner, building a sustainable bioeconomy. Stay with us.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
The role of biofuels in the future of industrial society has become a topic of increasing discussion and debate as the supply limitations and environmental consequences of fossil fuels have come into clearer focus. But can a future based on agricultural biomass really be sustainable in the long haul? Nick Jordan of the University of Minnesota and 12 colleagues address that question in a Policy Forum article in this week's issue of Science. Dr. Jordan is on the line with us now. Dr. Jordan, thanks for joining us.
Well, great to be with you.
In your article, Dr. Jordan, you note that a, quote, bioeconomy based on agricultural biomass is emerging in the United States. Could you just give us an idea of the scale of that bioeconomy right now and where it seems to be headed?
Well, absolutely. The bioeconomy, the part of it that really comes from agriculture, kind of has a couple of different parts. One is for electricity generation and for liquid fuels for transport purposes. And then the second broad kind of sector relates to so-called bioproducts, which range from paints and industrial chemicals and biodegradable plastics and a whole range of products that presently are mainly made from petroleum or fossil fuel-derived sources. And so if we think of those two sectors, the part of those sectors that really comes from biomass is about 5% in each case. The projections is that in 25 years or so, it seems reasonable that we could be getting something like 30% of our of what we currently get from fossil fuel energy from bioeconomy sources. And to transition considerably, we now use several hundred billion pounds of materials that are basically industrial products that come from fossil fuel sources, and the thought is that a large fraction of those hundreds of billions of pounds could come from bioeconomy sources.
But if I'm understanding, the article that you've written correctly, from the point of view of sustainability, it makes a big difference just how that bioeconomy actually is built.
Well, absolutely so. The basic issue is that if we get agricultural biomass for this bioeconomy from the sort of current agriculture that we have, which is based on production of just a relatively few annual crops. There's a fairly long list of environmental problems that are associated with that, that essentially have to do with degradation of soil and a number of problems around water, such as flooding hazards and pervasive pollution of water and the sort of pervasive loss of biodiversity in landscapes. And all these are kind of associated with growing relatively few annual crops. And so we feel that the security of these very, you know, fundamentally important resources for our future can greatly be enhanced by simply replacing many, certainly not all, but many of the annual crops that we grow now and are thinking of as biomass sources with a range of different perennial plants.
And this is, I guess, what you're calling in the article sort of multifunctional agriculture. Could you talk a bit about what that means?
Well, absolutely. The idea of multifunctionality or of a sort of portfolio of multiple benefits from agricultural landscapes is absolutely central to what we're suggesting. And what we mean by that is simply a landscape in which there is a diversity of perennial plants that are employed in key places across a landscape, for example, along waterways, where the ability of perennial plants to simply do kinds of, shall we say, useful work that annual plants simply can't do as well, is harnessed to produce good things, which are both sort of private goods and also public goods. So, for example, perennial plants just take much better care of soil than annual plants. Their root systems are proportionally larger and more active.
Because they're going to need it year after year, basically.
Well, that's absolutely right. And so perennial crops are well known for their ability to improve the quality and the farmability of soil. And they're well known for their ability to hold on to soil resources. And annual plants are known for their inability to do those things and for the tendency of the soil to degrade over time and for excess nutrients to wash away into waterways and become pollutants, for example.
Okay, so we have some potential benefits both environmentally and otherwise from this approach. Has it actually been tried anywhere? I mean, what's the sort of empirical evidence here?
Well, there's absolutely good evidence that perennial plants can do good things in terms of protecting soil, in terms of protecting water, in terms of protecting biodiversity, in terms of making more scenic and pleasant landscapes, in terms of improving microclimate. What has not really been looked into is a couple of key issues, the most important of which really is that most of the use of perennial plants in agricultural landscapes has been in a concept that, well, we'll take land that shouldn't really be farmed for annual crops and sort of set it aside and not expect it to do too much except have some perennial plants growing on it. In other words, it's not an idea that we're going to harvest something from that part of a landscape. And so it really makes a difference if one is, for example, thinking about growing grasses for bioenergy. One has to go in there and harvest the grasses. And so what will that do to the wildlife, for example? And what will that do to the water quality benefits that we know can come if these grasses are left more or less undisturbed? So it's that question of possible trade-offs and exactly how this sort of farming can be managed so that those trade-offs can be minimized. And also, importantly, it's this whole question of how does one make a working landscape, if you will, that is multifunctional, but also is producing some sort of commodity. And so that's really what we see as the next step.
Okay, well, let me ask you something, Dr. Jordan, just to close out here. What you're describing, this multifunctional approach, sounds like a very sound long-term, you know, way of doing this, but it seems to me the experience with fossil fuels shows that people tend to think and live, you know, very much in the short term. As fossil fuels become more scarce in the coming years, I could easily see people really getting focused on maximizing the short-term supply of alternatives at any cost without worrying, you know, too much about the long-term environmental consequences of one approach over another. Is there any way around that quandary?
Well, we think so, Stuart. The our idea is that there actually is quite a large coalition of folks out there who are very concerned about these key issues of the security of soil and water and biodiversity resources and about economic opportunity for rural places. And the key thing is to bring together quite a diverse range of stakeholders for some real critical thinking about how their various needs and concerns and interests can be accommodated in a multifunctional landscape. And we are experimenting with exactly that sort of critical thinking now here in Minnesota. We are working precisely to bring together these multiple stakeholder groups to essentially hash it out about, you know, how can we all harvest the sort of value that would be created by putting perennials in the right places in rural landscapes.
Well, Dr. Jordan, sounds like a very worthwhile undertaking. Good luck with it, and thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks so much, Stuart.
Nick Jordan is the lead author, with 12 colleagues, of Sustainable Development of the Agricultural Bioeconomy, a policy forum in the June 15th issue of Science. Finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
David, it's good to see you again. What interesting science topics do you have for us today?
Well, Tanisha, I've got three cool stories for you. As always, we'll talk about why you get the munchies after you exercise, a new vaccine that's made in rice, and finally, trying to find a planet just like home.
Wow, it all sounds very interesting. Let's hear about this workout chow down piece, as I'm sure some dieters are eager to hear about this.
Yeah, well, it could be good news or bad news for dieters. It's hard to say, but people that exercise regularly probably have a pretty hefty appetite after they exercise, at least most people seem to. And researchers were trying to figure out why this is. They thought it probably had something to do with hormones or something else within the body's physiology, but weren't exactly sure what it was. So a group of researchers recruited 12 volunteers, and they had six of them. Well, they gave all of them breakfast, which actually was just hot chocolate for breakfast, kind of a skimpy breakfast. Mm. But about an hour after they ate breakfast, they had half the volunteers. So six of the volunteers worked out on a stationary bike for about 60 minutes, sort of a moderate workout, nothing really hardcore. But the other six volunteers just sort of sat around and read. So they were sort of the lazy group. And what the researchers did was, while the group was eating breakfast and while they were exercising, and after the exercise, they had an hour off, and then they were given a buffet lunch after the exercise, an all-you-can-eat buffet lunch. And what the researchers did was, during the experiment, at various points, they asked the volunteers how hungry they were, and they took their blood, and they measured appetite hormone levels in the blood. And what they found is, when the exercisers were exercising, they reported lower levels of hunger than the people that were just sitting around, and they had higher levels of these appetite-suppressing hormones. But when the groups ate lunch, what was really interesting is that, as expected, the exercisers ate a lot more lunch than the people that didn't exercise. They ate about 20% more calories.
Wow.
Than people are sitting around. So that sort of confirmed this idea that people are hungry after exercise. But what was interesting was that the people that ate more, the exercisers, actually didn't report being any hungrier before they started chowing down. And their appetite-suppressing hormones were the same level as the people that just sat around. So the researchers say there's no real physiological reason they can find why we eat more after exercise.
Okay, well, if there are no physiological reasons, why do they suspect that people get hungrier?
That's a good question. I mean, this is sort of a study with that doesn't actually have an answer. I mean, it does tell us that hormones don't seem to be involved, but researchers think maybe it's something psychological. Maybe people just think, because they've worked out harder, that they should eat more. That's the only thing they can come up with now, but more research may tell us a little bit more.
All right. And next, the story about engineered rice that can fight cholera. This sounds really interesting and less invasive than a stick of a needle.
Right. And so another food story. But you're right. Well, cholera is a very devastating disease, especially in the third world. It's actually fairly easily treatable with antibiotics and water, but that's not always available in some of these countries where the disease strikes very hard. And so researchers have been trying to come up with a good way to have a vaccine against cholera. But vaccines, like you said, often involve needles, which can be expensive. They have their own problems with infections. So this group of Japanese researchers is trying to figure out a better way to do it. So they said, hey, let's put the vaccine in rice. A lot of people eat rice, went up with a vaccine in rice. So one of the primary cholera proteins is this protein called CTB. And what the Japanese researchers did was they put a gene for CTB in rice so that the rice would express this protein. And the idea was that if people were exposed to this protein, they would develop antibodies against it. And when they were exposed to cholera, they would be able to fight cholera better. And that's exactly what happened in mice. When the researchers fed this modified rice to mice, mice that were exposed to cholera didn't develop the disease, whereas mice that didn't eat the rice got the disease just the way humans would.
So can people eat this rice directly to protect themselves?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the issue is that it would be great if people could just eat the rice directly, but if people had a bowl of this modified rice, they'd actually be getting way too much of the vaccine, and it could actually be toxic to them. So right now, what researchers have done is what they hope to do for humans is grow the vaccine in rice, but then grind it up and put it into pills. So it still makes it more digestible, and it gets to the right places. The fact that the vaccine was developed in rice, but right now the researchers say you won't be eating a steamed bowl of genetically modified rice to protect yourself against cholera, at least not yet.
And finally, we move away from food and onto a possible second Earth in a galaxy far, far away, or at least out of our solar system, right?
Yeah, it is far, far away, about 20 light years away, actually.
Wow.
Which is pretty far away. And the story is this. Last April, a Swiss team found this planet, and it made big headlines across the world. This planet called Gliese 581c. Not what I would name a planet, but that's what they named the planet. And the planet was very exciting to them because in a lot of ways, it was like Earth. It was a rocky planet like Earth is. It was about five times as massive as Earth and about maybe 1.5 times the diameter of Earth. But they were really excited about it because it fell within what they called this habitable zone, which meant that it was just far enough away from its parent star where it wouldn't be too hot, that if there was any water on the surface, the water would still exist in liquid form. It wouldn't boil off, and the planet wasn't too far from its star that all the water would be frozen as ice. So they said, hey, this is a great possible Earth-like planet.
So does this mean this new planet, will become the retirement planet of the future?
Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like that. And the reason is because another team has reanalyzed the planet and has said they don't think it's as habitable as the Swiss team thinks it is. And the reason is because astronomers believe that planets need at least a little bit of carbon dioxide to support life. And what this new team is saying is if this planet has carbon dioxide, it's so close to its sun that all of this carbon dioxide would exist in the atmosphere, and it would cause a greenhouse effect much worse than we're experiencing on Earth. And this greenhouse effect would actually make temperatures on the planet above 100 degrees Celsius. So not a very, very nice place to live.
Isn't that as hot as Florida?
Not much harder than Florida, and it would boil off any water. But the good news is that this new team has actually found another planet with a very similar name of Gliese 581d. Again, not a name I would choose. But this planet does seem to be potentially habitable. It's about eight times the size of Earth. And it was also discovered by the Swiss team, but an analysis done by this new team suggests that it is actually far enough away from its star that if it did have carbon dioxide and it did have liquid water on its surface, that the water would actually remain liquid. It wouldn't be frozen. It wouldn't be too hot that it would boil off. So a potential retirement community 20 or so light years away, but could take us a while to get there.
Okay. Well, David, thanks for dropping in and, as usual, sharing your very interesting stories of this week.
Thanks for having me, Tunisia.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the June 15th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.